This is Stateside for Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we asked the governor why she wants to increase the gas tax to pay to fix the roads.
All of the other methods require a future legislature to hopefully appropriate the money, and that's why the gas tax was the smartest way about going about this.
We'll talk about the education crisis that everybody talks about.
And essentially, the adults are in a position right now where they're failing the kids.
We talked to a mobility entrepreneur about what's needed to succeed in Michigan.
Just having the technology isn't enough. We need to make sure that we're supporting the businesses that put that technology to use.
We ask what's behind a public university adding degrees in marijuana chemistry and business.
A product that was illegal and then it becomes legal and then almost overnight it becomes a multi-billion dollar industry.
Plus a look at the conflict over Native American treaty rights that still goes on today. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Today we look at the history behind treaty, hunting and fishing rights, and discrimination against Native Americans.
Indian fishers were seen as the bad guys, so that if you didn't get your bag limit one day on the lake, it must have been because Indian fishermen were taking the fish that you otherwise would have been able to harvest.
That's coming up later this hour. But first, the Mackinac Policy Conference, a gathering of business leaders, politicians, and activists, is underway on Mackinac Island. One of the topics is, how do we fix the damn roads, to paraphrase Governor Gretchen Whitmer? Well, we caught up with the governor earlier today. Hey, before we talk about roads, there's been some criticism from legislators in your party about the auto insurance reform that you signed into law today. How satisfied are you with that no-fault insurance overhaul?
Well, you know, it is a negotiation, and I think that anyone vested in the status quo is going to find, their issues with the resolution. But the fact of the matter is, this represents a step forward in terms of bringing rates down for people and preserving the safety net in Michigan, and those were the goals. It's not perfect, and we're certainly going to have to assess as we go and probably make some changes along the way as data comes in, but I think this represents a bipartisan negotiation that is far superior to the original bills as introduced or the prospect of a ballot initiative that would have wiped out the whole system.
Let's talk about the roads now. Recent polling and a report from the Center for Michigan basically can be summed up like this. People think the roads are bad and getting worse. They don't believe the state needs $2.5 billion a year more. It ought to be able to fix the roads with $1 billion a year or more. And finally, that money should not come from an increase in the gas tax, but come from cutting state government waste. I think the Michigan Chamber of Commerce president calls that fairy dust and wishful thinking. How are you going to persuade the people a 45-cent gas tax increase or its equivalent is necessary to fix the roads?
Well, let me start with this. I understand the public frustration with government that's not getting the job done. That's why I ran for governor. You know, 3 years ago, they raised the gas tax and told us that they solved the problem, and they knew darn well it was not enough to solve the problem. And people are justifiably angry, and that's why I put a real solution on the table. People need to see this is a $2.5 billion problem. We've got 1,100 bridges in the state of Michigan that are in condition that need to be replaced or repaired. And this is a dangerous situation that we have. It's compromising our economy. It is hurting our family incomes because we've got to fix rims on our cars as opposed to just fixing the roads the right way. And that's why when we get it done, everyone benefits. I'm going to work my tail off to make sure that we are successful on this because what keeps me up at night is the prospect of a bridge collapse. What keeps me up at night are the families that spend a week's income just trying to get back on the road because their tire was busted. We've got real work to do, and baloney is not going to fix the problem. As the chamber said, fairy dust, however you want to put it. The fact of the matter is, we've had politicians who haven't been honest with us, and that's why everyone's so mad and skeptical, and that's what I'm trying to remedy here.
Why do you think a gas tax increase is the best way to fund fixing the roads? Are there other kind of user fees you'd consider?
You know, certainly if someone has an alternative way to raise $2.5 billion and fix the problem, I am absolutely eager to have that conversation. But the fact of the matter is, a gas tax under the Constitution, Article 9, Section 9, guarantees every penny actually goes into the roads and bridges. All of the other methods require a future legislature to hopefully appropriate the money, and that's why the gas tax was the smartest way about going about this. I understand the shortcomings of it, but when the foundation is crumbling in such a way that People are fixing their cars or having to hire a tutor, or their kids aren't getting the educational outcomes they need, or they can't get into a path that leads to a high-wage skill. The foundation that's crumbling hurts people at the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum the most, but it hurts all of us, and that's what we got to fix in this state.
The Republican-led legislature does not seem to have much of an appetite for any kind of tax increase. What kind of conversations have you had with Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey and Speaker Lee Chatfield about that?
Had a lot of conversations with them, and both have acknowledged that we're going to have revenue to fix the roads. What that number is and where it comes from are the things that we have yet to work out, but the acknowledgement that it's a $2.5 billion problem that it's going to require revenue is the first most important thing that we all understand.
You know, a sizable number of those people polled indicate they'd be in favor of a wait-and-see approach when it comes to finding ways to fix the road. What do you think about just waiting to see if it works out somehow?
Well, waiting and seeing is a dangerous way to do business, and it's a foolish way to do business. The fact of the matter is it's a $2.5 billion problem today. We are at 78% of our roads in good to fair condition. In just 3 years, that number is going to be closer to 50-50, and the price tag is going to be closer to $3.5 billion. So wait and see is a dangerous, foolish way to proceed here. We've got to fix the problem, and when we do, every one of us will benefit in the form of lower bills on our to fix our cars and in a stronger economy.
There are a couple of other things that people brought up, and that is they believe some of the money for roads is getting siphoned off to other things, and that the Department of Transportation could require better quality road work than it's getting now. How do you get past the people's suspicions about how government's working?
Well, that's why truth in taxation is really important. And when you raise it at the gas pump, the Constitution requires every dime actually going to the road. So that's an accountability piece that I wanted to make sure that we had built into this plan. And also with regard to, you know, materials, we're going to use the finest quality materials so that we don't see cones going up every other year. But we haven't been rebuilding roads in Michigan in a long time. We've been patching them. We've been filling potholes, which means, you know, it's a temporary fix, and that's why you see those orange barrels every other year. When we rebuild the roads, we won't have to repair them every couple of years because they will be done right and they will last for decades.
Finally, what's your strategy to get road funding for the rest of this legislative year? What's the plan?
Well, you know, when we leave Mackinac after having a conversation about infrastructure, which is part of my keynote today, we'll continue budget talks in earnest. We're probably halfway through this budget, and this is where things get real serious and the real work gets done. So we're going to continue to push and sign a budget in before the legislature goes on their break.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer at the Mackinac Policy Conference. As always, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House is also on Mackinac Island this week, where he's been talking with leaders about one of the state's most pressing crises. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Hey, in your column today, you wrote that that crisis is K-12 education. What's your evidence for that?
Well, I think the evidence is a lot of the test scores that we see coming from students, fourth grade, eighth grade reading and math, continues to either decline or essentially flatline. It's not improving. And a lot of other states are improving. And so Michigan seems to be a place that is treading water as other states are getting their arms around it. Later today, former Governor Jeb Bush of Florida is going to talk to the group and talk about what kind of changes they made to make some real progress in educational attainment and achievement. And this isn't just in K-12. It's in college. It's in graduate school. It's a community college. And that those schools are producing fewer of the graduates than the economy is demanding. It's really been a partisan union versus management type of debate for years about education policy in Michigan. And I think people are finally saying this is just not working. And there's a broad coalition of business leaders, educators, philanthropy coming together to try and forge a common agenda. It wouldn't be necessarily legislation, but would be a common agenda to kind of get the legislature and Governor Whitmer to get her arms around some of this stuff and move forward.
In your column, you cited some stats such as by 2030, Michigan is projected to be 45th in the nation for fourth grade reading, 37th for eighth grade math if we keep going the way we're going. Michigan used to be in the top 10. How are we failing? What's happened?
one of the answers that I keep getting from people is that we tend to be too short-term focused. And if you and your listeners can kind of think back on politics in Michigan over the last 20-plus years, it has been kind of a partisan pendulum. There's the Engler years going to one direction. There's the Granholm years going to another. The Snyder years going to another. And that a lot of the reforms that each of those administrations have brought in or tried to instill in Michigan has been short-term and then abandoned by their successors. And what we're being told, or I'm being told, is that long-term strategic stick-to-itiveness, for lack of a better term, is really what is needed here. And it's also a recognition that this is a statewide problem. It's not just a Detroit, Saginaw, and Flint problem. It's happening in suburban Oakland County. It's happening in suburban Grand Rapids. And essentially, the adults are in a position right now where they're failing the kids.
You know, everyone running for political office stresses how important education is to them. There's a lot of talk in Lansing about improving education. I mean, what more do you want? They're talking about it, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that's the real problem, is there's a lot of lip service, but the stats do not back that up. And I think the real sum total of why I wrote the piece and why it's that whole issue is so big on the agenda up here is this notion among people in the business community, particularly, that, quote, people don't know about this crisis, end quote. And as people were saying that to me in reporting the piece, I said to them on multiple occasions, I said, you know, I and others, and I'm not the only one by any stretch, have been writing or broadcasting about some of these issues for years. So for people to say they don't know, it's like, where have you been? And then the answer oftentimes is that most folks say, well, my school district and my kids are doing fine. It's yours that's screwed up. And because we have this balkanized system of 550-some districts and they're not connected financially, you can't have the kind of massive financial crisis that we had with the auto companies in 2009 or the city of Detroit in 2013. And change has been driven a lot of times in Michigan by massive financial crises in which the people involved have no other option but to, in these cases, seek bankruptcy. Well, you can't seek bankruptcy protection for 550 school districts. So the question then becomes, how do you get your arms around it? And that's really the challenge before people.
Daniel Hiles is business columnist for the Detroit News and a regular commentator here on Michigan Radio. Thanks, Daniel. Enjoy the conference.
Thank you.
Coming up, who was Aldo Leopold and what's his connection to Michigan? We'll find out after the break. Stick around. The 5th annual Aldo Leopold Festival starts today at Les Chenaux Islands, and if you're like me, you might have to look that up on the map, but it's located in the eastern Upper Peninsula, about 30 miles northeast of the Mackinac Bridge. Joining us is one of the festival organizers, Elliot Nelson. Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
So, for those of us who don't know, who was Aldo Leopold and why are you celebrating him?
Aldo Leopold was one of the kind of first people to help found the conservation movement, really the founder of a movement called the Land Ethic Movement, which really helped open Americans' eyes to the value of wildlands and to the value of conservation land set aside specifically to help the ecology of the area. And so he's really known also as the founder of wildlife ecology, a whole branch of science. He was an amazing person who spent his whole life really dedicated to studying wildlands and to helping protect and preserve them. And so because of his, you know, life dedication to that, we try to honor his legacy by hosting this festival to help expose people to more of the nature in our area.
Well, given all that, how do you celebrate one of America's most influential naturalists?
Yeah, well, our festival is a great festival that highlights the diversity of nature in the Les Chenaux Islands area, which, by the way, is an area that Leopold grew up visiting as family. His family had a cabin there, so there's that connection, too.
But, oh, they vacationed there.
Yeah, they vacationed there. When he was a young boy, his family had a cabin out on Marquette Island, and he grew up kind of exploring the wildlands. There's maps that he created as a young adult there, as well as some bird lists that he kept and some photos of him from the area. So there's a lot of great evidence to show he really developed a lot of his love of nature in this Les Chenaux Island area. And that's really what we're trying to help inspire others to do, is to have that same love and appreciation for the amazing natural world around us.
Well, that kind of gets back to the original question. What should a visitor expect to be doing at the festival?
Yeah, so this festival has a number of field trips and talks to kind of founded around those two things. And the field trips go to see a variety of things. We have quite a few birding trips, which are really exciting. We get out to see these amazing little songbirds called warblers, as well as some waterfowl, and out to some of our wetlands around here to see some marsh birds. We also have walks to see flowers, specializing in orchids and some in carnivorous plants. We have a carnivorous plant hike this year, which is really exciting.
Be careful.
Yeah, exactly, right? Don't stick your finger in those ones. But then we also have some fern walks, lichen, insect walks, all sorts of diversity of the wild world out there.
Well, this is your fifth year doing the festival. Who comes to the Aldo Leopold Festival?
Yeah, our festival is targeted at both locals and those from all across the country, really. We kind of try to keep the price low, so it's really accessible to all. And we really see about half of the folks that come are just from the area that want to learn more about what's in their own backyard. And the other half come from all across Michigan, the Midwest. We even have folks from the East Coast and even as far as Arizona come out.
Yeah, he's got a lot of fans. You know, Aldo Leopold died just a couple of weeks after publishers accepted a Sand County Almanac, which outlines many of the philosophies you were talking about. But that book didn't really take off until a couple of decades later when it was issued in paperback. What do you think Leopold would think of a festival at Les Chenaux where people from all over come to celebrate his life and his thoughts on the environment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a Leopold scholar myself, so I can't say exactly how he'd respond, but you know, I think he would be a little surprised to see how long-lasting some of his effects are, but I think he would also be somewhat pleasantly pleased at the amount of protected areas. You know, the Les Chenaux Islands was named by the Nature Conservancy as one of the last great places on Earth, one of the most undisturbed and pristine habitats, particularly of this freshwater shoreline type left. And so a lot of that land, all the way from St. Ignace to Drummond Island, has been protected by the Nature Conservancy, the Little Traverse Conservancy, as well as our state and even some federal lands in there that all kind of ensure that this area really maintains its pristine sort of quality.
So where should I go if I want to attend the festival?
Yeah, well, the festival headquarters is at the Hessel Schoolhouse and Avery Center in Hessel, Michigan. It's one of the two small communities in the Les Chenaux Islands area. And all the info that is there and the registration is there. And most of our trips are based out of there when we travel to different places. So eldaleopoldfestival.com has all our registration information, the full schedule, and everything you want to know about the festival.
Elliot Nelson is one of the organizers of the Aldo Leopold Festival at Les Chenaux Islands. It continues through June 2nd. Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You know, it wasn't all that long ago that selling marijuana could get you into some real legal trouble. I mean, I guess it still could if you're not licensed, but with the legalization of marijuana in Michigan, things are changing. For example, Lake Superior State University in Sault Ste. Marie is adding two programs regarding marijuana, or if you prefer, cannabis. One is a degree in chemistry. The other is a degree in marijuana business. Joining us to talk about that is the president of Lake Superior State University, Rodney Hanley. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester.
What's your reasoning for these degrees in cannabis chemistry and business?
Well, you know, it's not very often in one's lifetime that you have something like this occur, where you had a product that was illegal and then it becomes legal. And then almost overnight, it becomes a multi-billion dollar industry in the United States. You know, and so there just hasn't been a lot of serious intellectual inquiry go on with cannabis. And so one of the things that we wanted to do at Lake Superior State was take a look at that, both from a scientific side, the chemistry side, and also the business side, and what it would take to be a business leader in cannabis in the state of Michigan and in other states, for that matter.
In one of your releases or one of the news reports, I forget which, it mentioned that they're expecting a lot of jobs to be created in Michigan because of this.
Oh, yeah. You know, some of the reports that we received say that by 2022, it could be a $1.3 billion industry and employ almost 28,000 people. And Michigan has the potential, because of when they legalized it and how other states have handled it, to have the third largest cannabis industry by about 2020. So this is not very far away. So there's tremendous growth opportunity in this particular industry. And very few schools are looking at it from an academic point of view.
What's involved in the cannabis chemistry coursework?
It essentially is an analytical chemistry course where you use lots of high-tech equipment to analyze the chemical compounds that are contained within the cannabis plant. Now, cannabis is a pretty complex plant. I'm not a botanist. I am a biologist, but I'm not a botanist. But the botanists tell me that, you know, the compounds inside cannabis are really, it's a complex thing. It's one of the more complex plants that you can study.
So are the students going to be using real cannabis? I mean, or is it just all theory?
Nope. We're using real cannabis here at Lake Superior State University in our studies.
Are there any special requirements or restrictions on who can take these courses, like age or, you know, criminal record?
No, we don't have any requirements like that, but we do have lots of requirements in how to handle cannabis, how to safely secure it and store it, and so it can't be stolen and so on. There's various licensing that you have to apply for to be able to study it for research purposes.
So there will be a background check of some kind somewhere.
Well, the teaching environment around cannabis will be a highly monitored type of environment. And of course, you know, all of our students that apply, they go through a pretty rigorous application process.
How is getting a business degree regarding cannabis production and sales different from other business courses?
Because we're looking at what's happening in cannabis specifically. So the interesting thing about it is, just take the state of Michigan as an example. You know, you can't go up to the bookshelf and say, hey, where's my cannabis business textbook? Because one doesn't exist. What that means is, we live the textbook almost every day. So within the state of Michigan alone, the environment is shifting beneath our feet almost on a day-to-day basis. Now, that's both an opportunity and also a challenge, but it's a tremendous opportunity for our students, because rarely in life does something quite like this happen. And so the students have a chance to be, through their day-to-day classroom experience, they're living the textbook every day.
You mentioned faculty, and I was wondering about that. I mean, where do you find somebody who's an expert in selling or the business side of marijuana, or for that matter, how much cannabis chemistry coursework do you have to become a faculty member who's an expert?
Well, that's not an easy task, I will tell you, because there's just not a lot of researchers out there that spent time looking at cannabis, and that's because it's been illegal. And so what we do is we look for the skills and expertise that are at the basal level below the cannabis. So do we have faculty that are experts in entrepreneurial businesses? And of course we do. And do we have faculty that are experts in analytical chemistry? And of course we do. And so we're able to take that basic expertise, apply it to either the cannabis industry or the cannabis plant, as the case may be, and be able to offer these programs. One of the things I like to say is, this is not your father's version of looking at marijuana. This is about serious intellectual inquiry. And so when I go talk to, you know, community groups or Rotary groups or whatever, one of the things I really emphasize is that this is not a program in, you know, smoking pot or anything like that. This is a serious academic program that when a student graduates, they will have a high quality education.
How popular do you think these cannabis related programs will be as far as drawing students?
Well, when we announced our cannabis chemistry program and our board of trustees approved it, I sent a text off to my marketing guy the moment they approved it, and we had a website go live. Within about 8 hours, we had about 5 applications of students to get into the program. Today, there are about 25 students enrolled in each program, cannabis business and cannabis chemistry, from states all over the United States and Canada, for that matter. And so it's an interesting thing. It is not Michigan-centric academic programs, but we're getting interest from the East Coast, the Midwest. We got a fair number of applications from Indiana. I don't know what's going on there that would elicit that sort of thing, but it was interesting. So we're really thrilled at the widespread nature of where our applications are coming from.
Rodney Hanley is the president of Lake Superior State University, which is adding coursework in cannabis chemistry and cannabis business. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, you're certainly welcome. Thank you.
One of the most competitive business sectors now is mobility, autonomous vehicles. One of the companies making headway in Michigan and beyond is May Mobility. It provides self-driving transportation linking people, for example, from mass transit to their final destination. A co-founder of that company spoke at the Mackinac Policy Conference, and Allison Malik joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Lester. I'm glad to be here.
There are a lot of money people, industry folks at the conference, and presumably part of your audience. What did you tell them about being a mobility startup company in Michigan?
So one of the things that I really focused on today about being a mobility company is that it's more than just the car. As we think about the work we're doing as May Mobility, our focus is on the service and the other services that we actually integrate with. And we think that for the state of Michigan to continue to really lead in the mobility space, we need to focus not just on the vehicles, but on the business models and various ways that we can all come together to support different forms of transportation.
I was looking at your website so we can better understand what May Mobility is. Tell me a little bit about how I would use your company or a unit such as Myla in your video.
Yeah, so May Mobility aims to transform cities with self-driving technology, making them safer, greener, and more accessible. We're starting today by reimagining transportation with the self-driving shuttle. Myla is a great example of that. And we're helping people get where they need to go safely, easily, and with a lot more fun. In the city of Detroit, we actually provide transportation helping Bedrock employees get from their parking decks to their office buildings. And we recently launched a new service in Providence, Rhode Island, where we're helping people be able to connect to Amtrak commuter rail, bus lines, and even bike share.
As I mentioned, the mobility sector is highly competitive. Some say it's kind of like the space race back in the 1960s. What are the big challenges for a company like yours?
So when we think about the mobility space, and especially autonomous mobility, there are two really big challenges. One of them is the robotics, and that's an area that lots of people talk about. You see lots of investment going into new types of sensors and trying to find software engineers. But the other part of it is actually making sure that we are applying this technology to the right business models, that we're coming in and figuring out how to advance transportation for everybody, leveraging the technology.
Investments in startups are incredibly important. A Cranes Detroit article recently noted the lack of Michigan venture capital invested in companies at the seed phase is a problem. What can you tell us about that?
So I personally actually work with the First Capital Fund out of Invest Detroit, and so I'm very involved in the early stage funding ecosystem, and it is pretty small right now. What's exciting is there are a lot of new initiatives that are coming on board to help create more funding opportunities for these early stage companies. What then becomes important is making sure that we get the word out. So if people have new business ideas, they know to reach out to places like Invest Detroit, like the MEDC, to help get networked into those investor communities. One thing that is really important is, as an investor community, that we realize some of these high technology companies are going to take a while to scale, and that's okay. They're going to unlock a lot of value and create really big companies. But at the early stage, sometimes there are a lot of questions, and we need investors to get very comfortable, because that's what early stage investing is all about.
Michigan wants to be in the center of the mobility movement. How is it doing compared to, say, Silicon Valley or Boston or other places like those?
So Michigan absolutely has a leg up on other regions like Silicon Valley or Boston from a hardware, technology, safety, and reliability perspective. We have some of the best engineers in the world that know how to build systems that are going to last for a very long time. One of the places where we fall behind, though, is really figuring out how we can support companies that are bringing that technology to market. Just having the technology isn't enough. We need to make sure that we're supporting the businesses that put that technology to use. And that's where I think Michigan really has an opportunity to advance, and we all need to pull together to do that now.
How would you do that? How do you go about making sure that happens?
So one of the focuses that I talk a lot with the MEDC team, and I actually had a chance to speak with the governor about, is this idea of multimodal transportation. That is the situation where you can have a trip and take lots of different options to help you get there. And so when we think about multimodal transportation, maybe you're walking and then taking a car or a bus, that is the future of mobility. And that's the future of mobility globally. If we want Michigan to remain a global leader, we need both public and private entities helping to create the atmosphere here in Michigan where we can all experience multimodal transportation, so we can use those insights to help us develop new companies, to have new services that fit into that ecosystem. We think it's really important that if we want to remain a global player in this mobility future, that we create the opportunities for people to try those things out here in Michigan.
What did you make of Governor Whitmer's challenge to mobility firms like yours to come up with a plan to get people around at the North American International Auto Show in Detroit next year?
We are really excited about the mobility challenge that was just announced and are looking at opportunities for how we can participate. We think it's opportunities like that where communities come forward and they identify their mobility challenges and let startups come and help give solutions are the perfect way for us to advance these types of opportunities for everyone.
Allison Malik is a co-founder and chief operating officer at May Mobility. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you for your time today, Lester.
After the break, the contentious history of hunting and fishing rights for Native Americans in Michigan and where things stand today.
It was, in general, a very uncomfortable situation for the folks who were trying to fish for a living.
Stay with us for that. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Michigan became a state after Native tribes ceded tens of millions of acres of land to the U.S. in a series of treaties. Those treaties said tribes kept their rights to hunt, fish, and gather on that land. But the state of Michigan didn't honor those rights until the 1970s. And once it did, there was an ugly backlash. Native Americans were threatened and harassed. Their fishing boats and nets were vandalized. Things have calmed down since then, but racism and harassment still keep some tribal citizens from practicing their treaty rights. Michigan Radio's Kay LaFond has more.
For April in the western Upper Peninsula, it's a pretty warm day. The Little Carp River, surging with snowmelt, winds through a forest of hemlock trees. Robert Rajasic is scrambling up and down riverbanks, expertly carrying a spear in his right hand. He's hoping to use it on some rainbow trout. He's looking for a flash of movement in the water. He's also listening. The fish have a distinctive sound.
Like a kid splashing in the water, their feet just a-going.
Rajasic is a citizen of the Keweenaw Indian community. We are on their reservation. He says his ancestors lived along this river, and he feels safe here. But other rivers and lakes off the reservation are a different story.
I'm more weary of what could happen. Who could possibly be offended by me being there to harvest fish?
Tribal citizens like Rajasic have treaty rights to hunt, fish, and gather off-reservation under their own rules, which are often different than the state's. And sometimes, non-Native onlookers and other sportsmen don't like that.
And once in a while, we do get the ones that yell at us, scream at us, or follow us around even, just saying all kinds of nasty things. Effing Indians this, or you're killing all my fish. This is why we don't have fish.
Every spring, Rajasic and other fishermen from his tribe have a special season when they can spear more walleye than usual. It happens on nearby Portage Lake, a water body connected to Lake Superior. Around a decade ago, Rajasic says somebody showed their disapproval by shooting a gun over his head.
And pretty much the whole town just went nuts. People were driving down to the docks, and they're yelling all kinds of things.
Tribal officials attended a meeting with local sportsmen to educate them about treaty rights and the tribe's conservation and fish stocking programs. But Rajasic says every spring there are still a few hecklers yelling and shining spotlights. This is not unique to the UP. Citizens from six tribes around the state shared their stories of harassment with Michigan Radio, most occurring within the last 5 years. They're called names, spit at, people call the DNR on them. Sometimes they just get looks or questions. Doug Craven directs the Natural Resources Department, the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians near Petoskey. He says some in his tribe feel so uneasy that they'll follow state regulations instead of tribal ones.
And so then they'll elect just to hunt during the state deer season, or they'll elect to just go out and fish with different methods, perhaps maybe not spearing, but they'll just do hook and line.
He says constantly having to explain yourself can be exhausting.
At a certain point, people, you know, just want to go out and fish or just want to go out and hunt.
Even Craven's 12-year-old son has been approached while fishing.
To have a non-tribal adult come down and, you know, and sit, that's very intimidating, you know, that's scary.
One of the common things we always hear is the tribal people, they take and they reap all of these resources and, you know, they're ruining the fishing economy or the hunting populations.
That's Dylan Jennings, public information officer for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. He says protecting fish and game populations is a priority for tribes.
They establish tax or total allowable catches on each water body. And, you know, the tribes really work hard to stay within their quotas, and they have.
A lot of times, a tribal citizen can take more deer or fish than a state hunter or fisherman, but then it'll be shared with their whole community. Jennings says he might get 10 deer in one season, and most of it doesn't end up in his own freezer.
That meat goes to funerals, naming ceremonies, other types of ceremonies, and it's also distributed to elders. And our elder center feeds our community elders every day, just about. And our elders just love deer meat, just love fish, just love all those things that, you know, are part of our way of life.
Jennings thinks those still upset about treaty rights don't realize what was lost in order to keep them.
That's a really important part of history to remember all of the sacrifices and things that the tribes up in these areas have given up for those abilities to harvest.
Tribal communities want their kids to carry on these traditions that are so essential to their culture. Robert Rajasic wants his three daughters to get involved in spearfishing, but he says there are some places he won't bring them yet.
I don't want them to have the fear of, you know, somebody hurting them physically or just calling them mean names. I don't want them to experience that.
But he knows he won't always be able to protect them. He hopes someday his daughters can practice their treaty rights without fear or intimidation. For Michigan Radio, I'm Kay LaFond.
The intimidation that Kay was reporting about was even worse in earlier decades. Here to talk about that and one of the landmark cases that helped change things are Catherine Tierney. She's an attorney for the Bay Mills Tribe who argued a case in court. And Jacques LeBlanc, commercial fisherman from the Bay Mills Indian community. He's the grandson of Big Abe LeBlanc. Is that right?
That is correct.
Yeah, they called him Big Abe, whose arrest led to that court case. So, Catherine, in the 1970s, tribal members around the Great Lakes were being threatened and assaulted by white fishers and hunters. What was the dispute?
The dispute was that tribal fishers wanted to use gill nets, which would be declared illegal gear by the state of Michigan. They were calling them lethal, non-selective devices, meaning that they were taking fish that otherwise would be available for sports fishing to harvest. And that meant that Indian fishers were seen as the bad guys, so that if you didn't get your bag limit one day on the lake, it must have been because Indian fishermen were taking the fish that you otherwise would have been able to harvest. It set up confrontations on the beaches, on the landings. People had to have their vehicles protected by somebody so that folks were not putting sugar in the gas tank or deflating the tires, or nets were being torn up. It was, in general, a very uncomfortable situation for the folks who were trying to fish for a living to be in.
Right. I remember reading a story about a tribe in Wisconsin where it actually came down to assault and things like that. How long had this conflict been going on by that point?
Well, by the time A.B. LeBlanc was cited by the state, people were sneaking fishing, you know, putting their nets in the dark, lifting them in the dark, so that they would not be, number one, discovered by Michigan DNR officers, and number two, not the subject of self-help enforcement by others who weren't happy about it. It wasn't until the Michigan Court of Appeals decision in October of 1974, where the court said that the right under treaty was preserved and still existed and could be exercised, that you had at least some legal protection for the exercise of the right, but that still meant that you had to deal with folks who didn't like it and would try to make your situation uncomfortable, and perhaps you wouldn't come back to that area to fish.
Well, let's talk about that case. Jox, what was your grandfather doing that got him arrested?
He went and set gill nets in front of the state DNR.
Right in front of him, and they saw him?
Yes.
So he,
well, he called him up.
Well, he was asked to be a test case. Catherine, did you ask him to be the test case?
No, his community wanted to have a test case, and he volunteered.
Hmm. So I take it he did it enthusiastically if he had called up the DNR to be there to watch it, right?
Well, how else was he going to guarantee getting a ticket?
So, Catherine, give us a little legal history here, because this ended up being the second of three big cases regarding treaty rights. Give us a little context, historic context, about what was happening in the courts at that time.
Well, there were several cases going back to the early 1900s regarding treaty rights to fish in the Pacific Northwest that were held by the U.S. Supreme Court to continue to exist, even though a lot of time had elapsed from when they were signed. And that was something that members of the Bay Mills Indian community took to heart, especially since in the 60s, the state decided that the future of the use of the water lay on the sports and tourism side of the equation rather than continuing commercial fishing, so that there was a concerted effort to reduce the number of fishing vessels and the number of licenses the state would issue, and to eliminate the use of gill nets as a commercial fishing gear. Now, that was something that was a type of gear that had been used by tribal fishers back to the time of Christ. You know, there are archaeology digs that have been found that, for example, in the Mackinac Straits area, so that it's not something that, you know, was new. But by making that restriction, it would be impossible for individual fishers, you know, to be able to take out a smaller boat, set their nets, lift them, and bring the catch to shore, so that there was a concerted effort to try and put tribal fishers out of business. And they fought back using their treaty.
Now, Jox, a lot of people would say, well, your grandfather was poaching. But as I understand it, he wasn't poaching. He was actually following the rules set out by the tribe. It's a sovereign state, right? So why didn't Michigan recognize that he had that right under the treaty that Catherine was just talking about?
Well, nobody had ever challenged the state prior to that. And that was what we decided as a community that we wanted to do, to uphold these rights. And ironically, here we are some 40 years later, and we're still asking permission from the state to exercise a lot of our rights given by those very same treaties.
Now, this was about conservation, DNR rules about conservation. Your tribe has its own conservation rules. Is this just a matter of white people kind of envying the fact that Native people have different rules that allow them to fish when white folks can't?
Ultimately, yeah. A lot of white people feel as though Native people are getting a way bigger piece of the pie than they are. And they feel as though they deserve an equal piece of the pie. But what most people seem to forget is that this was originally our pie, and we signed for these rights when we gave this land up.
This case, People versus LaBlanc, ended up in the Michigan Supreme Court. Catherine, how had the lower courts viewed the case at that point?
Well, the local courts, meaning the district and circuit court, upheld a conviction of Mr. LaBlanc for fishing with illegal gear, which would have been the gill net. The Michigan Court of Appeals reversed that conviction, saying that the right to fish was reserved in the 1836 treaty, and that there needed to be a determination made as to whether or not that specific regulation that the state sought to enforce was necessary for conservation of the fishery resource. But before it could be remanded, the state appealed to the Michigan Supreme Court, which ultimately held that the right continued to exist as well. So what we're talking about is whether or not the state of Michigan, under any circumstance anybody could think of, would have the right to regulate treaty fishing activities under this treaty. And the answer, at least from the Michigan Supreme Court, was it could if its regulation did not discriminate against Indian people and a ban on gill netting was perceived to be such a discrimination, and that conservation goals could not be met solely by regulating the white part of the fishery. And so ultimately that case became a guideline, but when the case also proceeded on a different track in federal court, the court there ruled that the tribe's regulations would apply to this activity to the exclusion of the state if the regulations were effective to protect the resource. And that's the rule that we've been following since that decision was reached in 1979.
In Kay LaFon's story, we heard that Native Americans are still getting hassle from white people about fishing and hunting rights. Is it a matter of Joe Average doesn't have an understanding of treaty rights? Or is it, going back to what Jock said earlier, they're just angry because there's different rules?
I think it's a combination of both. But remember, too, we have seen that affirmative action, per se, has been rejected either by referendum or by court decision in a lot of circumstances. And people seem to lump treaty rights in the same category as affirmative action, i.e. that one group of people are getting something that they don't deserve.
You've got a treaty for it. It's in law.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And the treaties are the supreme law of the land, along with the laws of the United States. And the case that I was talking about in federal court was brought against the state of Michigan by the United States. So it isn't as though people have a valid concern, you know, that if they could just bring it up to a sympathetic court, would be ruling in their favor. Treaty rights are there because of, as Jock said, the fact that those were conditions that were set by the tribes in order to sell their lands to the United States. One thing that Lester mentioned was the situation in Wisconsin, and I was the lead attorney for the tribes in that case for 10 years and came back to Michigan. But we all learned something from that, which is how, you know, if a state just signs off on court decisions and doesn't do anything proactive, you're going to have a huge backlash that really is dangerous to tribal members and their supporters and law enforcement personnel, because most of the people who were hurt in Wisconsin were law enforcement. So that when we negotiated a separate agreement by which inland rights to hunt, fish, and gather were going to be exercised in this state, the Michigan DNR and Attorney General's Office did a dog and pony show in various parts of the state to explain the decree and to be sure that there wasn't going to be a lot of backlash and people reacting angrily and violently to people who are exercising rights guaranteed by treaty. So I think that Michigan does deserve credit for making sure that the Wisconsin situation did not recur here.
Jocks, I got one last question. Do you feel safe when you go out fishing?
I do feel safe. There is definitely some conflict, and I think it relates both to what you were asking earlier, a lot of misunderstanding, and then there's just some racism out there. And where that derives from, I don't know. We have experienced some notes left on our trucks, some damage to our fishing gear on the ice, some things written in like the dust of the windows, and go away Indians, stop raping the lakes, stop catching all of the fish, save some fish for us, stuff like that. Fishing is a big part of our community, the Bay Mills Indian community. I am a third generation fisherman. And I'm just very proud to carry on traditions, especially the ones that my grandfather fought for.
Jacques LeBlanc is a commercial fisherman from the Bay Mills Indian community. Catherine Tierney is an attorney for the Bay Mills tribe. Thanks very much, both of you, about telling us about the hunting and fishing rights for Native Americans under the treaty that has been upheld and, you know, the bitter feelings that some white fishers and hunters have about those rights.
Thank you for having me.
It was an honor. Thank you.
That is the show for today. Hey, keep in touch with us, though. We like to hear what stories you're interested in. Tell us, and we'll find the experts to interview. Just get in touch by email, stateside@michiganradio.org, or find us on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Cynthia Canty will be back on Monday. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.